Welcome to the Voices in Recovery podcast. Voices in Recovery is produced by Freedom's Path Recovery Society, a registered Canadian charity. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider a donation at www.freedomspathrecoverysociety.ca. All donations go directly to assisting Freedom's Path and providing services free of charge and helps us keep the podcast going. We are grateful for any and all donations. This podcast discusses difficult topics such as childhood abuse, drug and alcohol use, sexuality, sexualized trauma, and more. If you are under the age of 18, please speak with your legal guardian prior to listening. The opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individual and not those of Voices in Recovery or Freedom's Path Recovery Society. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.
This podcast is being recorded on the traditional land of the Blackfoot Confederacy. This consists of the Kainai, Piikani, Siksika, and the Blackfeet in the U.S. We acknowledge the Stoney Nakoda, which consists of the Bearspaw, Morley, and Chiniki. We acknowledge the Tsuut'ina who are Dene, and the Métis Inuit status and non-status from all of Turtle Island, and those who are visiting. We are all treaty people.
Thank you for coming, Bo. I met you at a... obviously, an End Genocide, Free Palestine rally, I believe.
Yeah.
I'd seen you around before that. Please, take it away. Tell us your story. Tell us, like, what brings you out to these protests? Like, what's important to you? Like, we had a brief convo at the protest, but I don't want to get in the way of you, so.
Yeah, I mean, first off, like, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
In terms of, like, what's important to me with regards to Palestinian liberation movements is... I mean, personally, there's a moral impetus for me. I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. I'm also queer and trans. I'm not from here, but I've actually formed more community in Calgary than ever in my life.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, right? Because it's Calgary.
Yeah, actually, people are pretty friendly here for the most part. Yeah, I've experienced that. It's very much like kind of small town politics, big city vibe.
Yeah, that's for sure. As we were talking about, like, one of our small town, big city, like, sheriff, we were just talking about that, eh? Like, the Old West. Yeah. I remember just thinking, like, when he got on TV and was threatening people, I'm like, dude, you guys remember how bad the Old West was, right? Like, people remember.
Oh, CPS sincerely thinks that their outside communications are inside communications.
Yeah.
And that they're communicating, and they've articulated this. And I think it's nonsense. I don't know if they necessarily believe it, but this is what they say. They say that their communications are meant for officers.
I don't think so.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. Like, why bother? An internal memo would do just fine.
Well, and they have those.
Yeah.
And they communicate internally, right? Like, I volunteered with them for, like, almost 7 years.
They communicate internally. They've been fired as a client by every DEI firm they've ever hired. They're completely obstinate to change. They'll go to great lengths to obfuscate any issue that they experience that is out of line with the notion that every single one of their officers ought to, in their opinion, feel like a superhero.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I'm just like, who's watching the Watchmen here? Like, you know.
Well, and then you have, and then of course we know that their internal, like, their internal, what do they call it, professional standards?
Yeah.
That division is run by the chief.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, and I, like, volunteering with them, I obviously quit last year, when I realized that I just, after 2 years of fighting with it, like, I wanted to quit 2 years ago, like, as soon as. Yeah, with over queer issues, right? Like, I was a volunteer, and, like, I was the only queer person in that section, and it was called chaplaincy back then. They're changing the name now because we pressured them.
Yeah.
And one of my good friends actually really was a big part of that trend, of that process. And I'm just, like, it was just not soon enough for me, right? And even though things were starting to change, the people in my section, they were not having any of it. Yeah. They were all old fundamentalist Christians, right? Like,
yeah, it's really rough because, like, yeah, of course, people deserve support, right? Mm-hmm. And when you talk about chaplaincy, you're talking about, like, spiritual support to people. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't have to be offered under the structure of the police organization, right? That's just not necessary. You can partner with community organizations, which actually would be better because then they would actually have to speak with community organizations, right? And take part in community rather than simply coming down on it, or I don't know, taking a few pictures at the Humane Society every now and again.
Or what they're coming up to do, I think, in the spring, right? Aren't they going to be doing like town hall meetings around Calgary?
Yeah, we'll see how those go. I think we're planning on attending a few of them.
Excellent.
In my capacity with QCU, for sure. So Queer Citizens United is a grassroots organization that I work with. And we've been organizing, especially now, considering the Alberta government's rollout of their proposal for limiting gender-affirming care for youth. So we've been in contact with like every single Pride organization in the province, as well as community organizations and folks who want to get started on incorporating their own Pride in their small town. So right now some folks are headed up to Westlock.
Okay, I was just going to ask you about that.
After the flag ban.
Folks
are really... They're really scared, but at the same time, I've not seen this level of organization and collaboration in the queer community ever.
Nice. Excellent. Ever.
But the thing is, like, if you look at the history of Alberta and queer movements in Alberta, like, Albertans really do get shit done. Like, it's really not surprising to me. A good number of, like, legal precedents in terms of, like, queer rights were won in Alberta, right, by Albertans.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's disheartening to see so many people jump on the bandwagon that's, you know, rolled out by Take Back Alberta and folks like Mahmoud Moura and Danielle Smith and their friends. But at the same time, there's real strength in numbers here, and we've got a good number of people that are really raring to go on this.
Yeah. What is your take on the legislation, if I can ask?
Obviously,
we're against it.
Obviously, it's completely out of touch with 80 years of medical science and like proven trials.
Yeah.
On, for example, puberty blocking medications. Right?
I think you just said a word the UCP doesn't understand, though. Science. I don't think they quite understand that.
I think they do understand it, but I think what's more powerful to them and what has won them elections is rhetoric, right? Is fear. And there are folks even within our own community, I'm not even sure they're within community, but there is a group of people in Canada who call themselves Gays Against Groomers. They're the LGB Alliance type folks. So in Alberta, they call themselves Northern Light Alliance. We are actually keeping an eye on them. They showed up in a meeting with the Minister for Arts, Culture, and the Status of Women. And they were just... so obstinate about like very small minor things such as people having pronouns on their name placards on the Zoom meeting.
they would criticize that?
They can't stand any of it.
Yeah.
They can't stand any of it. To them it's indoctrination, it's this, it's that. And I'm like, you can change your gender marker legally in Canada to a gender neutral marker. It is legally allowed and it is precedent. And it's the smallest thing in the world to call someone that the name and pronouns that they would like.
But it's an easy sticking point for people who just want to stay where they are, right? Like,
yeah, a lot of folks are really, especially like in the case of Mahmoud Moura and
what happened with them?
Oh, well, I mean, interestingly, he started organizing with this group called YYC Muslims like years and years and years ago. It was, you know, a group for newcomers and Muslims to gather and, like, share in culture and all this other stuff, you know. And it started off as, like, a pretty innocuous thing, you know. It was pretty normal. But folks like Mahmoud Moura and his ilk like to take advantage of the fears of newcomers, specifically the fears of newcomer Muslim families, that they will lose their culture when they move to... Canada, and they'll be subject to things that will diminish their faith beliefs, their cultural understanding of one another, and take their families and sort of drive a wedge into them, mm-hmm. right? And that's like a really real fear for anyone who's like integrating into a new society. Mm-hmm. I think that's very reasonable,
yeah.
but at the same time, understanding that like human rights legislation is there for a reason,
mm-hmm.
and it's in line with the UN Human Rights Charter and so on and mm-hmm. so on and so on, right? Like all of these laws are here for a reason, and they're here yeah. to protect people mm-hmm. from harm.
Yeah.
Right, because otherwise they're just harmed and then they have no recompense.
Mm-hmm.
They have no ability to pursue justice, right? And you mm-hmm. see that, you know, in countries all over the world. I think yeah. there's, 71 countries where you can't be openly queer. Mm-hmm. Otherwise you face legal repercussions
yeah.
or you might be killed.
I'm shocked by that. And like that's still the case. Also, I guess it doesn't surprise me though, the states, down in the states, all these individual states starting to be more vocally and openly anti-queer, right? There's like anti-trans, but that's, to me, that's the beginning, right?
It's always the beginning.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, and people can't see that maybe, but that's the beginning.
Some of the first anti-queer laws were specifically about dress,
mm-hmm.
right? They were specifically about women dressing manly mm-hmm. or dressing in a way that does not suit their gender,
mm-hmm.
right? And that targets queer women, that targets, you know, queer mm-hmm. men, like anyone who, you know, isn't yeah. wearing a suit and tie or a skirt and a blouse,
mm-hmm.
right? So
and a skirt that covers your ankles, too.
Exactly. And in a lot of cases, like, people don't really see how quickly the slope turns mm-hmm. downward
yeah.
into just like utter elimination of presence in society, mm-hmm. right? You had, you know, even for the longest time, you know, the Hays Code in film,
mm-hmm.
People weren't allowed to see anything that was at all like morally
questionable.
Mm-hmm. They always use these like broad sweeping terms mm-hmm. to put down as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Right. And so right now they're being very specific about trans people,
mm-hmm.
but it's really a slippery slope. Like mm-hmm. people need to realize that like gay marriage is next, and probably abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
We've already heard from Pierre Poilievre
mm-hmm.
That he's, you know, talking about abortion, right? He's talking about, you know, inclusion in bathrooms, which is wild. Like, mm-hmm. we never had that discussion really in Canada.
Yeah.
It was never a problem.
Yeah.
It's a problem in search of a solution, and the mm-hmm. solution is winning them some seats.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the thing, because my understanding is no one's really presenting solutions in our mm-hmm. federal government right now. You know, the Liberals have some policy, but at the same time, I've seen some inefficacy on that front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are talking about a housing crisis, and, you know, we're trying to balance that with our stance or our status as, like, sort of a country that takes a lot of people in,
mm-hmm.
right? So where are we gonna have these people housed? Mm-hmm. Like, if they can't afford a home, if we can't afford a home,
yeah.
what makes you think a newcomer family who can barely make the same mm-hmm. amount of money as a college graduate here,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
If we can't afford it, they can't afford it. It's
as
simple as that, right? We should really be pushing on developers,
mm-hmm.
On development specifically. We should be pushing for Calgary to have more, like, high density housing
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, developing this sprawl where mm-hmm. we're probably going to overtake Airdrie in the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just doesn't
exactly.
make any sense.
Well, and the houses are just going to get more expensive too.
Yeah.
Right? Everything that goes outward.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the more supply there is,
mm-hmm.
the less houses will cost.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
So it's really, I mean, it's determined by a number of factors
mm-hmm.
as well.
So many.
Right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's
course,
if we're talking about simple,
mm-hmm.
simple, like kindergarten level yeah. economics, it's like...
Which is my level of economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. I appreciate you recognizing that.
Yeah, supply and demand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if there's more of something and people are buying it at a
mm-hmm.
reasonable rate to which the supply can meet the demand and then some, the rate of the cost is going to be low. Like, that's just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about, like, housing scarcity, which is what we're talking about now,
mm-hmm.
right? We're talking about, you know, what are we rolling out, 100 new housing units or something in the next 5 years or something like
it?
That? Yeah, it's really not a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it takes a long time to build things,
mm-hmm.
right? The thing that Calgary has a lot of is buildings that could be zoned into residential buildings mm-hmm. that are currently sitting vacant in our downtown core.
Yeah.
Right? Why don't we repurpose that rather than building something from scratch? Mm-hmm. Right? It's really quite simple. And that's a matter of municipal law. That's something yeah. that people can actually go tangibly to their government and ask for.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And it makes sense, right? Because yeah. they're just taking up like space and people are like literally dying in the cold and outside, right?
Yeah, they're sitting empty, right? Mm-hmm. Like I remember a long time ago, I used to work in property tax collection for an agency that did subcontracting for the city mm-hmm. of Toronto. They were also an auctioneer, which was interesting, mm-hmm. but they did like police auctions as well as property tax collections. And I remember, because they also had in-house bailiffs, mm-hmm. I remember hearing stories of people, like, 15, families of 15, like, just sleeping in storefronts because, mm-hmm. like, they couldn't afford housing and, like, their business was going under and they just needed a place to sleep, you know. That's not to say anything of the folks that were found no longer alive in, mm-hmm. in those businesses, right? Because they just couldn't afford it. And, yeah. and you're looking at inflation in places like Toronto and Vancouver, like, I don't know how anyone could live there
yeah,
without, like, living in, like, I don't know, like, a mm-hmm. commune or something. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, I think it's the idea is to get everybody living in a commune.
Yeah.
I don't know. But there's no other way to do it, right? Like, I was thinking, like, maybe it's about just getting people back into, like, one place, having whole families together. I don't understand it. If there's not a purpose for the huge increase of cost, right? Like a real purpose.
It's I don't think it's really purposeful.
Yeah.
I think it's a result of negligence.
Yeah. Right? Capitalism and negligence.
It's negligence. It's runaway mm-hmm. Runaway corporatism, yeah. I would say. Like capitalism is actually quite simple. Mm-hmm. Corporatism is not so much.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Similarly, like if we were to get money out of politics tomorrow, mm-hmm. no more financial lobbies, no more financial interests, limit donations to only small dollar donations from private citizens, mm-hmm. you'd have a completely different political landscape than you have now.
100%.
Yeah. Right? People are always so concerned about election reform. And like, you know what? I would love to have ranked choice voting. Mm-hmm. I would love to be able to vote, okay, I want this guy for sure. And yeah. if not, maybe this guy, maybe this guy, maybe this guy. Right? It's what they do in Australia. Mm-hmm. It works pretty well. But at the same time, a lot of folks are so resistant to change that mm-hmm. I don't see that really going anywhere in a really short amount of time.
Yeah.
I think the easiest thing to tackle would be financial investment in politics mm-hmm. And like gift giving. Mm-hmm. Like that's exactly how, you know, political bribes are yeah. just coded as gifts, right? Yeah. You can only donate, I think it's a few thousand dollars to a mm-hmm. campaign
okay.
As an organization or as yeah. a lobby, but you can give gifts
yeah.
that are much larger.
And that's why we just call it like that corporate politics, right? Like it's just all about, doesn't matter what party's there because they all get the same gifts. They all get the same pressure from different lobbyists and stuff, right? Like they're, no matter what party it is, that's why things seem to, for me, and don't get me wrong, I know change is always slow, like for, especially on a large scale, but it's pretty fucking slow.
Yeah,
it's considering there's a lot of people that are kind of hip to what's going on, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, you have these large groups of people, and they come from all different walks of life, who are so disenfranchised with the way that they're being represented by their mm-hmm. governments that they're just sort of like, why bother voting?
Mm-hmm.
Why bother voting?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not... the thing is, your political advocacy doesn't mm-hmm. stop at the vote.
Yeah.
And a lot of people really struggle to find the time because we're in a culture of total work. Mm-hmm. Like I myself, I have three jobs. I also wow. chair two community organizations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if someone's like, well, you know, where's your free time? I'm like, oh.
yeah.
Well, you know, if there were more people helping, then mm-hmm. I would have maybe a little more time. I could pass things off to folks
yeah.
and teach people like how to advocate for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of times when I have people who are interested in joining the work, it's really... it's really heartening to see that, mm-hmm. but also they have no idea where to begin,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think the best way to begin is to simply begin, yeah. right? You learn as you go. No one's a perfect advocate. No one's mm-hmm. a perfect activist. There's no such thing.
Oh, you just got to process, yeah.
Yeah, you have to be able to engage in the work and listen to those around you and be respectful to, you know, some things, right? You know, if you find something to be unjust or unfair, of course, like, speak up. But people are really shy to speak up, I think. They're afraid of being rejected or let down.
Yeah. And I think that also allows for a lot of the folks who some people say are too angry. I don't believe that. I believe everyone's angry, not angry enough, is my opinion. And that, because we've become a culture of, like, being angry is wrong, right? Like, and expressing your anger is wrong. Some people are incredibly frightened of people who are angry, right? And that's that's why oftentimes they get demonized in movements, different movements, whatever it might be, right? Is because some movements require incredible anger, right? And I can say, I don't understand it. I don't understand where it comes from, because I'm a white queer man, right? So I don't understand what it's like to be a black person, indigenous person, a person of color. I have no idea.
Sure, but you know what it's like to be angry at injustice, 100%. Right? So
that's right.
That's, of course, that's where you sort of bring in the listening component, right? Mm-hmm. You listen to other people's experiences and you integrate that, but at the same time, make sure you leave room for that person to advocate for themselves and support them, right? Yeah. Supporting someone is different than talking over someone or like going to bat for someone. Mm-hmm. It's really, it's a different dynamic.
I think it is.
Yeah, asking people, you know, what can I do to help that would be the most helpful to you, right? Like, you're in those two you know, phrases, you're asking, what can I do to help? And not just like leaving it to this person to like go through the litany of things that they need help with.
Yeah.
And you bring it back to like what that would be the most helpful to you right now, right? I think when I engage with work with other communities and other groups, like I remember I had joined up with Justice for Palestinians as a volunteer in my capacity as a board member at Queer Citizens United. I had reached out to them because I had heard from folks in the community that Mahmoud Moura had been at the first protest and had like commandeered the microphone, and like at that time was a really politically tense time for queer people and the Muslim community, specifically folks who were attending these rallies.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that like I had all the information before, you know, making any sort of judgment myself. I was just like, hey, is there anyone I can reach out to at Justice for Palestinians? Just so I can like clarify what's going on and let them know that like a bunch of people really want to support this, but they're afraid that being in close proximity to these people rather than across the street and, you know, behind two walls of police officers, that they might, you know, get hurt, you know? And I think that's a very real fear for people. They're afraid of getting hurt.
Yeah.
They're afraid of experiencing violence, and our political climate does not help those things.
No.
So I reached out, and it turned out that he was quite literally commandeering their space. He had gone in, you know, Mahmoud Moura, he's a Lebanese guy, and he curries favor with a lot of folks who are really homophobic, as evidenced by the way he's been organizing lately, a lot of anti-queer protests, specifically turning the conversation from the rights of queer people into the rights of parents. He's very, very close with folks with Take Back Alberta. I'm not sure who's paying for him to go to Ottawa on the regular.
Fundamentalists always come up with money, hey?
They sure do.
Yeah. Of all description, whether it's Christian, Muslim, whatever it is.
It really doesn't matter the color of the feather.
Yeah.
But
you said it.
But I reached out to them, and it turned out that he had just like
grabbed the mic, literally
availed himself of the microphone and like brought like 10 speakers up at someone else's protest.
Wow.
And and had been actually harassing a good friend of mine who's a part of the group as well.
Yeah.
Like there were criminal harassment charges brought to him as a result of that. Yeah. At Tamura, as a result of his harassment of Justice for Palestinians member. Yeah. He's gone on to call because he's actually no longer like permitted to go to these events because he's been violent and awful. He calls Wissam Cooley gay. He calls this other person as well gay, mm-hmm. For not capitulating to his anti-queer rhetoric.
Wow.
Right.
So if you're not anti-queer, you're gay.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Not you, of course.
Him. Oh no, him. it's some real like McCarthyite nonsense.
Wow. It sure sounds like it too. This time is actually reminding me a lot of what I've read about the McCarthy era, right?
Yeah,
like,
it's really descending into that kind of
it feels like
thing.
It.
Yeah. Because like you can't engage in you know, a reasonable discussion in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Some people I actually find like are just genuinely uninformed,
mm-hmm.
and they're just parroting what they've heard, mm-hmm. because that's all they know, right?
Yeah.
There's not a huge effort on the behalf of like the queer community to educate folks outside mm-hmm. of like workplace DEI, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes they'll come to like Calgary Pride or mm-hmm. another, you know, Pride event or something that's a little more open to the public,
mm-hmm.
right? But for the most part, like the queer community is kind of to itself and, mm-hmm. you know, for good reason, right?
Well, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Yeah. And, but like you mentioned something earlier, it's very understandable when people are afraid to get hurt, right? And they don't really understand things. And that, but what I hope is that we can push through that little bit of fear sometimes, right? And not in terms of having to do things one way, but just in doing something, right? To try to, I guess, help us evolve, maybe? I don't know. I don't even know what to call it.
Yeah, I think, like, I've had plenty of conversations with people mm-hmm. over the last, like, 2 years. Some people, specifically when we were doing defensive protests, mm-hmm. I wouldn't even call them protests. They're defensive demonstrations
mm-hmm.
at the Calgary Public Libraries
yeah.
As a result of, like, folks coming in and trying to disrupt the Reading with Royalty program.
Mm-hmm.
Just so we're clear, the program is by registration only. Mm-hmm. It's not, like, a public event, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's in a room by themselves. There's really, like, nothing happening that's untoward,
mm-hmm.
Especially if you're someone who's a fan of Disneyland. Yeah. Right, people are dressed up as princes and princesses,
yeah,
very modestly, mm-hmm. I might add, to read books
yeah.
to children between the ages of like 6 months to like 4 or 5 years, like parents who have time during the day, because mm-hmm. these events are at like 10 a.m.
Yeah,
right. Some of these like wackadoos, like Larry Heather, right, who's run for Calgary mayor a number of times. He's a public nuisance.
Unreal.
Costs the city thousands of dollars every year in enforcement. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Unbelievable.
Him and his friends, mm-hmm. including a few other notable guys, Derek Reimer, who else? There's so many of them.
Yeah, well, I guess like on the one hand, now being a member of the queer community, it's disgusting to me that people would protest this, like obviously, because it's just about ignorance from my perspective. Like as a child, just so I'm clear, like I was not abused by a trans person or trans people. I was abused by married men, right? Like
yep.
who had children, who were either, maybe they were like, whatever they might be, I don't know. But that's how they presented. They were churchgoers. They were, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this like hysteria about that is, in my mind, it's ridiculous, right? Like I just don't get it. Except for bigotry. That's all I can think.
Yeah, it's about power. Honestly,
yeah.
It really is. It's about power and maintaining a structure of hierarchy mm-hmm. over queer people, over trans people.
Yeah.
Right. They don't like to see that other people are getting their human rights because mm-hmm. to them that no longer gives them license to just abuse people.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think for people like Larry Heather or like Danielle Smith or
mm-hmm.
like Take It Back Alberta, it's really
yeah.
about the like well-being of their communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about their spiritual beliefs. It's not
mm-hmm.
about their religious beliefs. It's really, really not. It's about power.
Yeah.
Right. They can use our identity and our status in society and abuse it to gain power.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm from a small town. I'm from Thompson, Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
Right. My hairdresser was trans. All my life, she was great.
Mm-hmm.
My other hairdresser before that, like I think from age like from very, very young to like 5 or 6, my hairdresser was like this really charming alcoholic, but she was definitely drunk every time she cut my hair.
Yeah.
I can tell you who wasn't drunk when she cut my hair. My trans woman, Barbara.
Yeah.
She was great. She took very good care of herself. Mm-hmm. She was like a contributing member of the community. Mm-hmm. But I remember as a kid, apart from experiencing just like regular kids being mean about like silly things, like, mm-hmm. Body shape or being racist because mm-hmm. they've heard it from their parents. I remember hearing about my hairdresser and like people would just say the most like cruel things about her. Mm. And I was just like, why are you talking about her like that? Mm. Like, she's a really nice person and like she's never done anything wrong to me. Mm. She's never bothers anyone. Like, mm. she's funny, she's nice, she's smart, she's talented, she's great at cutting hair. Mm. What's your problem with this person, right? She was also, in Thompson. It's a small mining community, about 15,000 people. Mm. It's surrounded by around 16 different First Nations reservations. And a lot of them don't have potable water, mm-hmm. right? So you're in a community that's already so blind to, like,
insane.
Human struggle.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't stick around very long.
I don't blame you.
But also, tough. When I was young, as soon as I started to be, I guess what people would classify as like visibly queer, mm-hmm. I was not allowed to I was ostracized. I was not allowed to hang out with like other girls. My age or at all, really. Like, mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to have sleepovers. Not because my parents said no. Mm-hmm. My parents were, like, actually generally quite good in that way, yeah. right? But I wasn't allowed, to hang out with other people, other girls specifically my age.
Yeah.
And, of course, I wasn't allowed to have sleepovers with boys either.
Mm-hmm. Of course not.
No.
Can't win for losing.
No. So I really plunged myself into becoming a really voracious reader. Mm-hmm. I learned to play like 7 instruments growing up. I was mm-hmm. a band geek.
Well, you're incredibly sharp.
I mean, it's not for lack of trying, that's for sure.
No, for sure.
But
practice.
I think, a lot of small towns really get into this, I will say it wasn't even a political issue. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even a political issue that this person was trans or that I was queer or anything like mm-hmm. that. It was just interpersonal bigotry,
yeah.
right? And it was that people wanted to feel bigger than the other person.
Yeah.
And that's what leads me to believe that this even on a grander scale, mm-hmm. on a systemic level, is really not about values.
Mm-hmm.
Power. It's about power.
Yeah. Yeah, that hits hard, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you think about it, if it's all about power, well then, yeah, no wonder we all feel a little bit fucked up.
There's a thing, this type of power, right, is in many ways available mm-hmm. to people who are so inclined to take part in a system that is designed mm-hmm. to, essentially make nice and simultaneously ignore certain issues in favor of others,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that personally, I would be interested in running for office. I know mm-hmm. that it would be extremely emotionally taxing,
mm-hmm.
and financially taxing, blah 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 yeah. blah blah. Right?
But maybe more so emotionally,
Yeah, it's really tough to deal with people who are being disingenuous
mm-hmm.
and are going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah, well, they're hugging you and then stabbing you in the back at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And then, crying about, why aren't we invited to Pride anymore?
Yeah, well,
yeah.
That's
the first thing you hear when you meet with any conservative MP is, especially as a queer person in this community, if you're meeting with an MP to discuss issues facing the queer community, mm-hmm. the first thing they almost always, it's like reading a book. They want to know why they're not allowed or not invited to our Pride Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really simple. The Conservative Party in Alberta and federally owes a great debt to queer people.
Mm-hmm.
And until that debt is acknowledged,
mm-hmm.
and some form of like reparation is made between their community and our community, because they're not the same community, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
Then we're not talking about the same thing.
No.
You want a symbolic gesture. We want meaningful action, right? So it's as simple as that. I think symbolism is often used in a way that again, distracts from real issues. I gave a speech at one of the Palestinian solidarity rallies, the one that you were at, actually, most recently. And
great speech, by the way.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's really important that people understand that they're being distracted by culture war issues rather than being able to address real issues, right? Like, how many MPs have called for a ceasefire in Gaza? How many, right? Because I can tell you,
probably zero.
I can almost certainly count them on zero hands.
Yeah.
Right?
Don't need hands for that one, yeah.
No, no. And, you know, we get, you know, from the government of Canada, too little, too late, you know. We could take Israel off of our list of approved countries to sell weapons to today.
Yeah.
We could have done it yesterday. We could have done it 10 years ago, you know. Could have done it after the March of Return when, you know, IDF soldiers made sport of crippling people for life. You know, taking out knees, as many knees as possible, just popping them off. These are peaceful protesters.
Yeah.
And people wonder why, you know, resistance isn't always peaceful, right? And it's because, well, you know.
Well, I'm sorry, you step on my neck long enough and then let me up, I might not be happy.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's really... also, it let's just be really, really clear. It's guaranteed under international law that if you are being occupied, that you have the means, you have the ability to resist by any means necessary, including violent means. And that is protected under international law. And that is all international law that we all agreed to, okay, including the U.S., including Israel, including Canada. So there's a lot of that. I also get from... you know, a lot of folks who like to make this, again, a culture war issue. Well, if we allow Palestinians to have full rights in the land of Israel, Palestine, and let's say, okay, let's say there was an end to apartheid and there was a one-state solution, let's say. I honestly don't personally care, you know, one state, two state, red state, blue state, like...
as long as the murder stops.
As long as the murder stops and people have the right to self-determination.
Yes.
Israel can solve its problems another time, you know, in and amongst themselves, because they do have some really serious problems. It was really interesting to me that, you know, World Pride was held in Tel Aviv, you know, a number of World Prides back. But they still don't have gay marriage, right? It's not recognized by the state.
It's window dressing.
It is window dressing, yeah. They have, like, ceremonies, and they'll give you, like, a little ticket, but it's not recognized under the law.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the, you know, the TELUS Convention Center having their affirming status removed.
Yeah. Yeah, the rainbow registered.
Rainbow registered. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But seeing like churches do it all across Calgary and knowing some of these churches, it's a little bit disheartening because I've been in a church long time. I'm not anymore, but I was, and got to know obviously lots of churches, and some of these affirming churches, they are not affirming churches. Like they are absolutely not. Like Central United, not an affirming church.
Interesting.
Has never been. And some of the people there are like, were actively a part of what used to be called celebrate life something, which was a form of conversion therapy.
Right.
And that these individuals were still there, right? So, and I know that everyone wants to be like quick maybe not quick enough, I don't know. But it seemed like everybody just wants to accept the window dressing and move on, right? And I guess I'm just a little madder than that. Like, I'm not okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. If they were actually doing the right thing, you know, and let's just get back to my one state solution example mm-hmm. in a moment. But if people are doing the right thing, I don't care why. Mm-hmm. I don't care why you're doing the right thing.
100%.
I really don't. You don't have to be, you know, feel it in your heart of hearts and, you know, that you like wholeheartedly agree, mm-hmm. but you at least can recognize that you're no longer causing harm mm-hmm. and that's enough for you, mm-hmm. right? I think that if anyone could really get to that place, I would appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
We're talking about harm reduction here. 100%. Like you're allowed to like believe till your dying breath mm-hmm. that queer people are subhuman and are gonna burn in hell. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that's for you to believe. Like don't bring this into mm-hmm. public discourse, right? Because it's actually nobody else's business what you believe.
No, of course.
It's really not. It's really not.
I agree.
And you shouldn't couch those feelings on people mm-hmm. who really don't care. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you can find people who actually do care about that. You can.
100% right? You can.
And if that's the life you want to live, then, you know, bless mm-hmm. your hate-filled heart. You can go ahead and do that.
Well, that sounds so funny. Bless your hate-filled heart. I like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that. I'm not going to lie to you. I'll probably steal that.
Oh, no. That's perfectly okay. I'm just trying to get back to...
The one state solution.
Yeah. So if there was a one state solution tomorrow, there would mm-hmm. still be a lot of massive problems to mm-hmm. rectify. Like, how do you change the entirety of the Constitution of Israel?
Yeah.
Right? The real issue that people seem to, like, cling to when I'm having conversations with other Jewish folks who mm-hmm. maybe aren't as sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. They say, well, if the Palestinians were integrated tomorrow, they would have a majority over us, mm-hmm. right? They would have a majority over us, and then that would put us in the same position that we're in every other country in the world. We'd be a minority, mm-hmm. and they'd be able to vote for their interests, and it would put us at risk. Well, I'm sorry, but like if your concept of risk, mm-hmm. right, is determined by first off conceptualizing of all Jews as mm-hmm. like sharing the same interests, mm-hmm. which is simply not true. Wow. I've heard people say that all Jews are the same ethnicity, which is bizarre to me, because like Jews have lived in diaspora among other people in other countries, among other cultures, for millennia. Mm-hmm. At what point are you, like, you're a Canadian, and you move to Turkey, mm-hmm. okay? At what point does your family become Turkish? Mm-hmm. Right? At what point?
Mm-hmm. Interesting question.
Well, there's no clear answer.
Of course.
I can tell you right now, like, anthropologically, sociologically, and otherwise, there's no clear answer. There's no clear definition of ethnicity. Oh.
Right there.
Yeah.
So. Are we good, Darcy? Right on. I can't remember what we were talking about. But you were telling me, you were talking about the one state.
Yeah, specifically regarding a one state solution. Yeah. Like a lot of folks in the Jewish community, specifically those who are a little more sympathetic to Israel, in this case, the argument is given that, you know, once, if there would be a one state.
That's right.
If apartheid ended tomorrow mm-hmm. and we had to integrate, 5 to 7 million people into Israel proper. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure they would call it Israel at that point, but who knows? Then there would be outnumbered.
Yeah. So that's their concern. There
would be a voting majority of Arabs.
Yeah.
And they find that to be a threat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a threat.
Yeah.
And similarly, they conceptualize themselves of being all of one ethnicity, right?
That's what you were talking about before you left.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think, like, I hear from a lot of folks who have been fed this myth of Zionist thought that all Jews are of the same ethnicity because, you know, 3,000 years ago, you know, thousands of years ago, we came from Judea, Samaria, mm-hmm. right? But that really, first off, grossly simplifies the concept of ethnicity. mm-hmm. right, in such a way that, like, you know, I don't say that I'm Polish or Russian because my, you know, great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were Polish mm-hmm. or Russian,
yeah.
right? That is a historical fact about my family, mm-hmm. right? And that would be part of my ethnic background.
Yeah.
But is that my ethnicity?
Mm-hmm.
I would not say that.
Yeah.
There are many determining factors of ethnicity, right? Mm-hmm. And there's different definitions of ethnicity. Some people, for example, in the United States, ethnicity is actually more akin to a classification of race mm-hmm. rather than your cultural, the way in which you integrate certain aspects of culture and you're part of certain cultural groups, mm-hmm. right? And for that reason, to say that, like, you're one ethnicity, all 15 million of you mm-hmm. are the same ethnicity, although you live in different countries and have different customs and so on and so on and mm-hmm. so on, right? Like, yeah. That just makes no sense. It mm-hmm. makes no sense for anyone to say that, right? Like, yeah. You wouldn't call an African-American African, mm-hmm. right? But you can mm-hmm. say that their family... was, you know, trafficked in the transcontinental slave trade, mm-hmm. and they had originated in Africa, yeah. right? And that's perfectly fair to say. But, you know, when folks go from America to Africa, let's say they want to learn where their family came from, mm-hmm. that's fine. But do they get a plot of land and do they get to steal someone's house? No. Mm-hmm. No, they don't. Displacing other people for themselves is just, it's not right, mm-hmm. right? And bringing it back to, like, a moral imperative, if we're talking about, like, Jewish culture and the way a Jew is defined, even in religious law, mm-hmm. right? If you're born a Jew, it's because your, like, eternal soul accepted the 613 commandments in Jewish law.
There's 613?
There's 613.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's intense.
Yeah, being a Jew is more like a job description mm-hmm. than it is than it is an okay. ethnic identity or.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. It sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah,
it's
actually really interesting. Like, mm-hmm. so if you're born to a Jewish mother, because and in some reform circles it can be Jewish, like paternal lineage as well, but for the most part in Scripture, in the law. If your mother is Jewish, she gives birth to you, your soul has accepted the 613 commandments, and okay. here you are. Your duty is to observe them as a Jew.
Okay.
If you convert, which Jews don't proselytize, they don't say, they don't advertise, they're not like, oh yeah, you should become a Jew.
I've never seen that.
Never. Mm-mm. It's not a thing we do, it's not necessary, mm-hmm. right? But if you convert, and the conversion is you know, accepted, and you know, as in, like, you've joined a congregation and all these other things, then you have to observe the 613 commandments just mm-hmm. the same, and you're considered a Jew in good standing or whatever, in the same status as someone who was born a Jew, mm-hmm. right? But the thing is, once you accept that responsibility, you can't convert out of it.
Okay.
You, even if you're like, actually, I don't believe in God anymore, I don't believe in this, I don't believe in that, well, under Jewish law, you're still technically subject to the 613 commandments.
Okay.
And you can't, like, revoke your Jewishness. Once you accept your Jewishness, you can't revoke your Jewishness. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, it does become a little confusing. People mm-hmm. do seem to think that it becomes more of an ethnic identity. Yeah. And some parts of it are. Right? Mm-hmm. The tradition, the religious, the social aspect of it, the fact that it's an identifiable group, mm-hmm. right? All of those things fall into line of an ethnic identity.
Yeah.
But similarly, you could, in certain circumstances, especially in more homogenous areas, consider queer people to be of an ethnic identity of sorts, mm-hmm. right? And similarly, if we're talking about whether or not you need an entire nation state to be safe, mm-hmm. right? It's simply not true, mm-hmm. right? Queer people were also victims of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. among many other groups, you yeah. know, including, like, Romani, political pacifists, mm-hmm. including Jehovah's Witnesses, like, you name it, anyone yeah. who is not falling in line. It's just that, you know, Jews were the immediate target, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, lots and lots of queer and trans people were murdered in the Nazi Holocaust as well.
Yeah.
But you didn't see the League of Nations clamoring amongst each other to give them a nation state after that. No, they adopted humanitarian laws, you know, slowly but surely, in a good chunk of the world. Of course, we know, as I said earlier, you know, 71 countries or something. It's still illegal to be queer, and there are varying degrees of punishment for that. But at the same time, you don't see a nationalist movement for queer people. That's just, you know, I've definitely heard it once or twice in my lifetime.
Have you?
Like, oh, maybe we should just get an island, you know? but even that concept, getting an island that I would assume would be under the circumstances that we're not displacing an entire, demographic of people. With their own, you know, history and homes and ethnic culture and so on, right? And putting them into open air prison, keeping them under our thumb for the better part of a century.
Yeah.
Right. Another thing that people really tend to be confused about is they're told that Zionism and the establishment of the state of Israel are one and the same, right? They're two sides of the same coin. Zionism began as a political and cultural ideology in the late 1800s, right? And some of the first settlers in Palestine moved from Europe to Palestine in the early 1890 is around the time that the first Zionist convention was held. 1901 is when folks started leaving Europe as a result of European anti-Semitism, like as a result of genuine oppression and violence, right? They started to, organize, and by 1901, they started moving to Palestine. And there were several, massacres and so on and so forth before World War II ever started.
I know. I just started reading a book about it, and it's amazing. Between 1890 and before even World War I, what was going on there under the English colonial, expansion.
The thing is, the British had actually requested the assistance of Arab militias to assist in defeating the Ottoman Empire during the First World War. And they had promised them the land.
Yeah.
They had promised them a sovereign state, right? And it wasn't clearly defined, of course, but that's a good part of why they were so upset when all of a sudden Lord Balfour is saying, who himself is actually a famous anti-Semite, is saying, oh, well, you know what, actually, we'll give you 60-40, and the European Jews here, they'll get 60, you get 40. Who wouldn't be upset with that? Mm-hmm. You're about to get a whole cookie and then 60% of it gets eaten by someone else.
Yeah.
So,
and then turn around and tell you to appreciate your 40%.
Yeah. So of course, that would be insulting to anyone, right? Anyone who put their life on the line for your regime to win in a war.
Yeah.
Right. A good deal of Arabs weren't treated badly by the Ottomans. Mm-hmm. They just weren't.
Yeah.
It was about power.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right. So I think a lot of the misconceptions about Israel-Palestine, about what it means to be in danger, right? A lot of it's hyperbolized. Someone had said to me, Israel, was established as a place for Jews to be safe. And I'm at what point have Jewish people in Israel not feared for their life in one way or another? Have not gone to a bomb shelter before they go to shul? You tell me that is a safe place?
Yeah.
When's the last time you hopped into a bomb shelter, sir? Because I can guarantee you it's almost zero times.
Zero times. Yeah. Zero times on
unless it was at a museum, maybe, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I happen to
think... It
wasn't
a daily ritual, whatever.
No. Yeah. It's not a regular thing. We don't need an Iron Dome. I think that, when people refer to Israel as if it's some sort of insurance policy, I'm first off, what's your premium on that policy? Because it's pretty high if you ask me.
Same tie, that's for sure.
How many Jews have to die in Israel before that insurance policy is worth it? Mm-hmm. And you know, let's just remove, you know, the discussion about people that you're currently dehumanizing. But like, really, how many people in your own community need to die by clearly unnecessary violence? Mm-hmm. Like, Israel could have been established as a state, right, in a number of countries, all of which they refused because they already had people there. They already had people who had started taking the land anyway, started taking stuff anyway, burning farms anyway. Like, of course, when people say, oh, they refuse, well, yeah, sure they refuse, because they were convinced that this was the thing that, that they could get away with, right? And that it didn't really matter to them that it cost these people their lives, their livelihoods, their freedom.
Their homes, right? Everything.
Yeah. And I think that's wrong. Like, I think that's wrong. And I think
it sure feels wrong.
It definitely is wrong.
Yeah.
But you know, I think for people to conceptualize of Israel as like this safe place for Jews, it is the most dangerous place in the world to be Jewish. Right? And someone had argued to me recently, oh, well, you know, in other, like, Muslim-majority, like, countries like Iran, Iraq, you know, and Indonesia and so on, it's really dangerous to be Jewish. You have to hide. Mm-hmm. And, I brought it back to this parallel with queer people. I'm just like, yeah, well, it's just as dangerous to be queer in those countries, actually. Mm-hmm. Do queer people need a state of their own to be safe? No, they don't.
No,
they can and should resist any form of oppression that they're facing, right? Or you know, in many cases, a lot of folks did leave that place for a place that's safer for them, right? Like, there's tons and tons of like 2SLGBTQIA+ like refugees that come here to Canada, right? Like. Because it's not safe for them, and it's untenable for them to live any reasonable quality of life anymore.
To think about people leaving their homes, right? There has to be this, like, innate need to leave, because it's their home, right? And I think a lot of folks that I've encountered, myself included, when I was growing up, can't understand that, right? To be forced out of your home for one reason or another. And it's not for me to judge why people leave, because the only thing I need to understand is there's a good reason. People don't leave their home for no reason. We are no different in terms of being human, right? Like, we wouldn't leave our home for no good reason, right? Yeah. We wouldn't run away for no good reason. So for us to assume that people leaving don't have very good reasons, right? And that in order to fight that, because of course we love our homes,
yeah,
right? And who doesn't, right? Yeah. Like, It's one of those, it's really tricky when talking to some folks about the immigration and refugee status and all the different ways people come to Canada, right? Mm-hmm. And to think that it's like this, like, we're gonna give you a crumb and you better be grateful, right? Like, because if we give you a crumb, that means that's all you got. We're gonna let you come here, but we're not gonna let you be yourself, right? Or we're gonna try to get you to assimilate you, right? Whereas I know it's worse in the States for the attempts at the constant, like, to me, when I was down there, growing up down there, it's like the constant conformity, right? Like, if you're not, even if you're queer, as long as you're like choosing the right side of some argument, you're okay, right? Yeah. As long as you're in the right state also, right? Mm-hmm. Like, as long as you're in California.
You can't more or less.
Right? Like, I mean, it's, and even California, I'm sure, eventually will fall prey to some of this, like, lunacy that we're seeing in terms of bigotry, right, in politics.
Well, you see that sort of thing, honestly, especially in, like, vulnerable, marginalized communities, mm-hmm. right? Like, you see people on the street at Artur Pawlowski's street church, right? You go into that man's YouTube channel, it is full of, like, homophobic, Islamophobic, racist vitriol. Yeah. It's still up. Like, I've reported it a number of times. It's still up there.
Yeah, I reported a few of his shit to you. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's just allowed to do it under the veneer of providing food, which, honestly, our government should be providing food, right, for these folks who need, like, a leg up, right? Yeah. But instead, they're being pushed into these extremist circles by people who are willing to, you know, bring some tea and cookies once a week.
Yeah.
Like, it's just shameful. Like, our society could do better and actually meet the needs of those people, you know, instead of pitting one another against each other for, you know, more than a few crumbs, right? Is it really worth it for a few crumbs? Yeah. You know, you could share a pie with everyone instead of having a few crumbs.
Mm-hmm. I know. It just makes more sense to share, right? And for some of us, I guess, not for everybody.
Yeah, like, you know, there's always something that some folks will, they'll find a way to, you know, move away from more of a caring, I wouldn't even say like communist, like that's not at all. It's mostly just like,
we have to be careful with that word too.
Well, here's the thing, like, everyone's needs should be met, and that is like the core tenet of communism. That is the one core tenet is that everyone should have their needs met.
Yeah.
If you've read like two sentences of Marx, then you would know that.
Yeah.
I'm you know, of the opinion that there's no perfect political schema.
Of course not.
And certainly it's been, you know, studied that like a small commune, it only really serves about 150 to 200 people, like, in terms of like being able to provide for yourselves and all these other sorts of things, and also the like political difficulties that happen when you have more people in an area.
Yeah.
Having little pods like that all over the place is also just like not efficient for the type of world that we live in. You know, 9 billion people.
Are we at 9 now?
Close.
Oh my goodness.
If not over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if you think about breaking off 9 billion people into little pods of 150, there's not enough land on this earth.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely
not. Let alone not enough land to like till food and, you know, provide resources like, you know, electricity and things like that. Like, it's just, there's not enough land on this earth for that to be feasible.
Yeah.
There are like ways in which I think that, you know, anarchist structures of like just community care, being able to like provide, you know, what's available to you, and like reaching out and making sure that like folks don't necessarily have to be at the whim of large systems to access care, right? But that also requires time, right?
Yeah.
and I'll bring it back to people are in this culture of total work, you know? You have to be an insanely efficient person to be able to participate in community care unless you're someone who is also struggling, right?
Yeah.
And you have the time. Right, you're someone who is on maybe a disability benefit. Maybe you've got a structured settlement. Maybe your parents, you know, are able to support you, and you have the time to contribute in that way.
Yeah.
Right. Otherwise, you've got to be some kind of like super organized person, or at the very least, have a good amount of energy.
Yes, energy is imperative to keep it going. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And like emotional capacity too, right? Because like you're dealing with people who in a lot of cases have it really, really rough. And the emotional toll it takes to engage in helping, in helping in a way that is like in a good way.
Useful for the person.
Useful for the person, helpful for them in the long term. And it's not taking too much from you also. Like you have to be able to care for yourself before you can care for someone else. That's just a simple truth. And sometimes those things happen simultaneously. You know, I have a younger brother who, he's 23. He just had his first kid. And it wasn't planned. He was really scared, right?
Well, I bet that's scary.
Yeah. But, I mean, he's doing really well. He really stepped up to the plate. He's, I think, of my four younger brothers, he's the most responsible. But, it was really scary for him. Yeah. But he just fell right into it. And for some people, it's just like a right place, right time kind of thing.
Yeah.
I know for me, like, in terms of engaging in community work. I had done some work with like nonprofits before, and I of course had shown up to protests and you know, lent a hand there. For I think the first like 10 years of me living on my own, I left home at 16. Once I graduated high school, I was out of there. But I moved to Winnipeg for a bit, and then Hamilton and Toronto area. I lived there for a good amount of time before moving to Calgary. And it was really tough to actually get involved in like community organizing in Toronto, because I was just really new there, and I was just one person among like millions.
Oh, and so many like, folks, yeah.
Yeah, so it was tough. Like, and at the time, I was actually myself on disability, so I didn't have a whole lot of like financial means, but I always showed up and helped out where I could in terms of like being able to help more effectively now. Like, I have a good job now. I have a car. You know, that really helps. Those are like the two main things that you really helpful. Need to be able to like contribute in a way that's not limited, right, by your own means.
Yeah.
And I got into community organizing because I was in community, and I saw some folks sort of getting together around issues, and I was just like, oh, I could do that. You know, could do that. I've worked in like more formal structures. I actually worked in at a nonprofit that was providing foster care services in northern Manitoba, and that was really tough.
Yeah.
That was really tough work. I mean,
that's hard work.
It's hard work, and also, like, because of it being in such a remote area, there's not a lot of people who want to move to Thompson, Manitoba.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Certainly not a lot of people with social work degrees, of which I am not one. But I did receive a good amount of training. Mm-hmm. They recruited me because of my private security background, if that tells you anything. Mm-hmm. But I'd worked in private security for about 5 years, and then I had moved back to Thompson for a little bit after a family member of mine had passed away. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, I wanna give back to the community. I wanna do something to help, right? And I know that there are a lot of foster kids in care, right, who could use someone stable who isn't a jerk. Because I think a lot of people from my hometown aren't very sympathetic to Indigenous folks or anyone really besides themselves or their immediate family, right? I think that, you know, a lot of folks that I worked with, the thing that was the most difficult about that job was understanding like where these kids had come from, right? The majority of which were, you know, children of survivors of residential school. They were, you know, children of survivors of day schools, whose parents had their children apprehended from them. They weren't given, in my opinion, and in a lot of cases, and this is just proven historical fact, not given any chance, really, to like help that situation, right? No real chance at all. If you don't have freaking drinking water, what makes you think you're going to have the resources and the, like, ability to form support networks, right, that aren't simply based around meeting, like, the bare minimum of your needs as a person, let alone teaching you, or not even teaching you, but, like, allowing you to have the capacity to get care enough for yourself to care in such a way, or like, again, have the infrastructure where that's not, how do I say, apprehension isn't the first method being used, right? And that in a large majority of cases is true. Apprehension is the first tool. Yeah. Sometimes it happens when people have just simply given birth, right?
I know.
Like they're profiled and then their children are apprehended.
Yeah.
Based on what? Racism, obviously, is the answer.
Yeah,
but like,
100%.
So working in that environment, like, I was still in my early 20s, and I knew and I was aware of the way in which our government interacted with First Nations foster care services. And I remember the most taxing part of that job was working with people who just, like, did not care. did not care.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, these young folks, they were being primarily cared for by, like, white folks who are not qualified. Mm-hmm. Not qualified.
Not only not qualified, but in some cases completely indifferent.
Yeah, yeah. That too, right? Like, you're given Indigenous awareness training. Yeah. You're given nonviolent crisis intervention training. You're given mental health first aid training. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you how many times I was called at like 3 a.m. for crisis calls because no one else was coming for this youth who is experiencing like a mental health crisis in a remote area where there is no psych emerge mm-hmm. in Thompson, Manitoba. If you're having a psychiatric episode, like you can be held at the hospital for 48 hours, but then you're shipped to Winnipeg, mm-hmm. right? That's it. There's no specialized care.
That's all they got.
That's all they got. There's not even like, you know, you can't even take the Greyhound bus anymore because those are toast. They're gone. So that actually eliminated a lot of like healthcare access for mm-hmm. folks. But yeah, I got countless crisis calls from youth just like who just wanted someone to talk to mm-hmm. most of the time. Like, of course they were having a hard time and you know, they missed their families and maybe something else was going on at school or mm-hmm. or whatever. But like, it's just like they just wanted to be heard.
Yeah.
You know, and that like leaving that job was really, really hard. I only left like when I moved to Calgary. Mm-hmm. And I actually worked like another job as well. I was working in the evenings as like a line cook in Thompson. And then I would do the overnight shift mm-hmm. at the group home. And, I think like working in that environment really prepared me for like understanding different ways in which people seek care, mm-hmm. like in informal ways.
Yeah.
Because in my formal capacity as a worker, mm-hmm. I could only do so much,
yep.
right? And it would be inappropriate for me to do other stuff
yep.
than that, right? But, you know, the thing I think that really meant the most to these kids, and of course, like I would ask permission mm-hmm. at work, whether or not it would be okay to say hi to them outside of work or anything yep. like that. And it was really those like more informal interactions that were really more, I think, meaningful to these kids. It's
way more powerful to them.
Yeah. Like they just want to be seen.
Yep.
Right. They want to be seen instead of being ignored
or talked to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really that. And it of course like helped our dynamic at work, but at the same mm-hmm. time, like it was just a decent thing to do.
I think it would be the right thing to right? do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think like the way in which I engage with community now is mostly like, I really like to get to know the people I'm working mm-hmm. with. I really would rather meet up with someone and have a conversation rather than talk to them over text or like mm-hmm. email or something. I just find that to be so cold and like it's not helpful.
Yeah.
It doesn't give someone a sense of like who you are and how you feel, yeah. right? Or
there's no nuance.
No nuance. And I think like a lot of folks are trapped into this, you know, text-based communication mm-hmm. to reach out for help or to be, ask to be heard on an issue. You see a lot of folks, you know, arguing in comment sections mm-hmm. instead of just like, and these are people they know, right? Like
yeah.
you could have a conversation with someone and disagree with them.
Totally.
I think that's fine. And certainly I think some people are sometimes a little quick to dismiss others. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are people that I disagree with that I know they don't mean me any harm. And, mm-hmm. and I know, and certainly it's not such a severe agreement that like, mm-hmm. you know, they want me dead or something, yeah. you know, like, it's usually yeah. not that.
Yeah.
I can say that like, some people have, again, like varying degrees of knowledge on issues mm-hmm. specifically regarding oppression, right? And community care and what they want their community to look like and what it means to achieve that. Like, how do you get to a community that cares for one another, mm-hmm. right? How do you get that? Because I see some folks in community who are doing good work. But I see that when they're not doing that, they're spending a lot of time, policing others, like policing others
yeah.
and what they're doing and how they're talking and all these other sorts of things.
Yeah.
When like, these are people who have like shown up, mm-hmm. they've shown up, they've given their time, right? And they're well-meaning, they're mm-hmm. clearly here to help, right? But if they say, you know, one off-color thing that might be informed by a bias. Yeah, mm-hmm. of course. But, like, who's putting in the work to deconstruct that, mm-hmm. if not your community?
Yeah.
Because when people are in isolation, they become radicalized. Yeah. That's it. They become radicalized. They become indifferent. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, yeah, of course, like, I have really hard conversations with people around, like, anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Because I actually, like, growing up in Manitoba, I didn't experience a lot of anti-Semitism, actually. Not a lot at all. In fact, in Thompson, there were only two Jewish families, mm-hmm. my family and another family. And we just got together, you know, I just got together mostly because my family's not practicing. Mm-hmm. I got together with this other family for holidays and things like that. But, I find that... When people don't have someone to, like, sort of reflect those mm-hmm. ideas off of or bounce them off of and you know, get reasonable feedback that's not like, you're a terrible person, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. like, immediately, yeah. it goes straight to that. And mm-hmm. and I'm just like, that's just not helpful for anyone. And I think if someone was calling you a terrible person for saying the wrong thing one time mm-hmm. in text form.
Yeah,
that you would probably feel the same way. You'd feel defensive. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be open to having a conversation about why that's wrong and what you can do mm-hmm. to change and like how that's impacting other people. Mm-hmm. And this really common, I think, attitude of people saying, well, it's not my job to educate you. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know what? It is your job to educate people. Mm-hmm. It is. Because like, and not always, of course. Mm-hmm. There's limits. There's always limits. Mm-hmm. Right. Again, if you see someone engaging with you, and you can generally tell if someone's being disingenuous,
100%.
If they're just trying to get your goat, right? Like,
or their stuff is window dressing. Or,
yeah, exactly. Like things like that, where you can just say, like, if we're not engaging, like, on the same level of understanding at all here, that, like, let's just talk about the definitions of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because if you're talking about an idea without clearly defining it, you're not having a discussion, mm-hmm. right? You're not having a discussion at all. So if you're telling someone that what they're doing, you know, you're defining, let's say homophobia as a concept, mm-hmm. right? You're defining, oh, well, you know, making fun of someone being effeminate or, you know, what their bedroom habits might be, mm-hmm. of course, like, it's just, doing that in public is just so incredibly rude, for one.
Yeah.
And second, it contributes to a culture of homophobia. It mm-hmm. makes other people think that it's okay to say those things.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the majority of people I've encountered where, specifically as it relates to anti-Semitism, again, in Manitoba, there was only two Jewish families. Mm-hmm. And I will say, like, I had more flack for being queer than being Jewish, right? And I, you know, of course I saw minor things here and there, like a Jew joke here and there, mm-hmm. but it wasn't directed toward anyone.
Yeah.
It was just, again, this parroting that people hear something and they parrot it. You know, there was, I think the most I had ever experienced was after the movie Borat came out, you know, like,
oh my goodness.
Right. Yeah. And I think similarly for, you know, for other folks, it was, you know, specifically Muslim folks and Arab folks experienced it after, you know, Team America World Police came out. Which, you know, if it was in a vacuum, isn't a terrible social commentary. Mm-hmm. But when you've got children watching it and parodying it and so on and so on and so on, it becomes vitriolic and racist really fast.
Oh my goodness. And now, right. I mean, now looking at it, it's just 100% all those things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, just because of the cultural impact it had. Yeah. Again, like, some things can, again, nothing exists in a vacuum. It just, you can't consider things that way. And I think, again, like, the film was made by two white guys who were, like, undoubtedly, like, blitzed out of their mind when they wrote the script.
Yeah.
But that doesn't give them a pass, right?
No,
it's clearly a harmful piece of media.
Yeah.
As
so many other pieces of media since September 11th came out.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, that was like almost like a go hard card, right?
Yeah.
For bigots and people who practice and repeat and pass along Islamophobia like regularly, right? Because I couldn't even tell. It was just so like everyone's patriotic, right? Like, oh yeah. And then you realize after things start exactly what that means.
Yeah.
Yeah, it means that.
I think like the way in which like anti-Semitism presents itself in the modern era in large part is very easy to ignore, right? Because there's actually like a really good book called like 200 Years of Conspiracy and Anti-Semitism. I'm pretty sure that's the correct title. But it talks about in the book that the majority of modern conspiracy theories actually all trace back to like anti-Semitic
Really?
myths.
Okay.
Yes. And it is true that like a lot of this, New World Order, World Economic Forum, you hear all these buzzwords now,
Yeah.
but you hear the same story about these, or the Illuminati, or this or that and the other, this secret shadow society. It all reeks of like, protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is like,
Oh, okay.
yeah, it's really the parallels are really clear if you understand like the history of anti-Semitism.
Ooh, I just got
And
goosebumps. I think I understand way too much now.
yeah.
Whoa.
And of course, like if you're talking about, again, financial corruption is real, right? There are real conspiracies to talk about, but the word conspiracy has just become such a dirty word.
Well, and that's not, it's tied to Israel, not necessarily Jewish people,
Exactly.
right? Like,
Yeah.
and I think, like, what I hope people can separate is that, right? Because I don't believe, well, in my mind, and I can be totally wrong because I am known to be ignorant, but in my mind, they're not the same thing,
Well, I
right?
mean, does the Canadian government speak for you at all times?
No,
No, it doesn't. So it's
not
very
not even,
simple.
yeah.
It's a very simple parallel to draw, right?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for using that parallel because it is simple that way.
Yeah, it really is. A lot of people, because they don't understand Jewishness and Jewish culture and Jewish faith and so on, that they, again, get tied up in this mystery. Right? People conceptualize of Jewish people as this like secret society. Well, it's not. It's not. These are average people who happen to have, a spiritual belief and a culture around that belief, right? But to say that there's like some secret organizing that's happening that's at all dissimilar to the way any other government functions is just false.
Yeah, it's like that, and that's the thing. Like, Israel is a country, and so they have a government, and therefore they are inherently not going to do great all the time, right? Like, just as a country, like in general. But then on top of that, you add in the, well, and I don't understand anti-Semitism. I really don't. Like, I grew up in a time where that wasn't, at least it wasn't overt around me. Like, now that you're talking about stuff, my brain's like, wow, it is everywhere, right? Like, because
It
once you
is.
start to notice it,
I
then you can see it.
remember, yeah, I remember moving to Alberta and hearing more just like casual anti-Semitic jokes at the bar. Like I would go get a drink after work and I would hear these like people talking, and then all of a sudden there's a Jew joke. There's a Jew joke, there's a Jew joke. And I'm like, what? I don't think either of you have met a Jew in your life. Right? But I experience the same thing as a trans man, okay? I experience the same thing with misogyny. It's everywhere, 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 right? And
Yeah,
I,
welcome to our world.
yeah,
Hey.
yeah, I'm just like, okay, wow. No, and people are really overt about it. And I'm just like, because I pass, and because people would never know, never know. They would never know. They would never read me as a trans person. I'm just a short king, but they think that it's safe to say those things around me. And of course, like I very much take some amount of joy in challenging that because I'm just like, things I like to say. And it's usually like little off-color things. I'm just like, well, when I was a little girl,
I love it. I love it. Well, when
Things,
I was a princess,
yeah,
that's how I would
exactly.
say
I'm
it.
just like, well, so, and then they're just like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, why don't you think about it for like 5 minutes,
And maybe longer if you need
maybe longer, or I'll just
to.
say, I lived the first 22 years of my life as a woman, so do you want to rethink that, or do you want to talk about it? We can talk about it because it's clear that that feeling you're having is more about you than it is about her.
Right? Yeah. That's a more of a you thing.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of this is projection, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of ways in which people try and connect with others is mm-hmm. through like shared dislike.
And it happens sometimes just naturally, right? Yeah. Like where people come together and it's like they're talking about those things and they happen to like bond over those dislikes.
Yeah.
I try to bond over like love and stuff more so than dislikes, but it happens, right? Yeah. Like it happens yeah. sometimes.
I think like I don't think
it's bigots. Yeah. I'm not gonna lie, I don't like bigots.
Yeah, I think like I have had to have really strong conversations with like my grandparents prior to now. Mostly regarding actually like the hijab ban in Quebec.
Mm.
And they were posting some stuff on Facebook, and I like fought with my grandma on Facebook. And I should have called her. I should have called her.
It happens.
I did call her after that though, mm-hmm. because I was just like, she was upset with me. I was just like, no, grandma, like that's not right. Mm-hmm. That's not right. And nobody's hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. Like every Halloween, everyone's wearing a bloody mask. So mm-hmm. like, who is it hurting? Are you worried about someone attacking you? And why are you worried about a Muslim person specifically attacking you? Mm-hmm. Why do you assume that a Muslim person in particular has more of a tendency
and
to be violent
to
you than anyone else? Mm-hmm. I want you to really think about that. Mm-hmm. And she removed me from Facebook after that. But a number of years later, we had a conversation mm-hmm. about it again. She didn't bring up the topic again in that time, of course. Yeah. Like, I was obviously not the person to talk to about it. But she really came around on the issue. And I was just like, well, you know, that's... Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you agree now. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, at the time, it was really surprising to me that you had that opinion. Because mm-hmm. I don't know you to be a hateful person.
Yeah.
You know? And I think, like, once the tensions sort of, like, went down, it was much easier to have that conversation.
Yeah, of course.
It can happen a lot faster than that. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, again, are really scared of rejection. They're yeah. really scared of someone they care about, you know, not meeting their expectations. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I would ask of people when they're having hard conversations with family or friends is that, like, you give that person room to grow. Like, mm-hmm. you can set boundaries
yeah.
with regards to, like, how you engage with people. Well, I don't want to talk about this topic with you anymore until, you know, we can have a more even-handed discussion because mm-hmm. I feel like you're coming from a place that is not well-informed on the issue and I've given you the information. Mm-hmm. Like, it's usually at that point where you either, you know, have, like, a breakup with someone
yeah.
over, like, an issue that obviously is a really important issue, mm-hmm. like Islamophobia and xenophobia and racism and so on are really important issues. Mm-hmm. But again, like these people don't exist in a vacuum.
Yeah.
They're your expectations of them do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
Right?
Yeah.
And adjusting that for the person you see in front of you rather than the person you conceptualize in your head
yeah.
is important for not only them but for you and your health, right? Mm-hmm. Like understanding that like, hey, maybe this person's not quite there yet. And, like, maybe we can have a few conversations here and there and maybe invite them to have, you know, ask you some questions rather than arguing about the mm-hmm. issue. And just like, well, it seems like you don't know a lot about this. And maybe it doesn't have to necessarily be said in that way. But, you know, it seems like maybe you have some questions that are unanswered about it. And that's why you're kind of jumping to the conclusion that you should, you know, remove it from your life, mm-hmm. right? Or remove yeah. it from society. And I'd like to wonder, I'm wondering, like, why that is. Why is it that you're more worried about X person doing Y than you're worried about, you know, A person doing B, you know? Yeah. People talk about terrorism.
Yeah.
And I think people really misunderstand terrorism mm-hmm. because it's often not classified as a crime committed by people who are marginalized, mm-hmm. right? When the majority of terrorism in Canada has been perpetrated by white folk.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Specifically French Canadians, actually. Mm-hmm. And specifically around like language preservation. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a Tim Hortons, a McDonald's, and a bunch of places that were just bombed, right? Like, just straight up bombed in Canada. Mm-hmm. But those are the majority of terror attacks in Canada on Canadian soil. So when
since 2001, though, mm-hmm. right? Like, September 11th. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
Ever since then, it just seems like that's what we call people who disagree. We'll put groups of people who disagree, like terrorists, right? But except for people who are, like, literally terrorists. Like, there's, like, I have friends who were put on some lists and stuff, and it's just ridiculous to me. Like, because what we've been told now, because of 2001, September 11th, they can call terrorism whatever they want, right? And people are so scared. Like, it's like the rhetoric politics, right? Like, the UCP uses lots of rhetoric, conservatives use lots of rhetoric, right? That fear based rhetoric.
Well, most of it's word salad that doesn't mean anything.
Thank you. I was going to say word salad. Yeah. Like, you're picking my brain.
Yeah. No, I think we mostly agree on that. It's it's really, here's this thing you don't understand. Let's ban it.
Yeah.
Let's ban it instead of, like, educating people about, like, mm-hmm. the actual effects of, let's say, puberty delaying drugs or puberty blockers, right? Because first off, people are, like, worried that, your child might not be able to reproduce. Mm. Well, that's simply not true, right? Mm. That's simply not true. Mm-hmm. These medications were developed for mostly folks who experienced precocious puberty. Mm-hmm. So between the ages of, like, 8 and 6 and 10? Where they start to experience puberty, that's mm-hmm. way too young, mm-hmm. right? Like, that child is not going to be able to emotionally cope mm-hmm. with the physical changes that are happening to their body, mm-hmm. right? And in a lot of cases, this medication is given to folks with developmental disabilities and things mm-hmm. like that as well, where, like, they're harming themselves or others, like, just, you know, as a result of their condition, mm-hmm. because they're not able to cope with those sorts of changes in that way right now, mm-hmm. right?
They're other just things not ready yet.
Need to be addressed first, right? Yeah. And I think that, again, there's been no conclusive study saying that there's going to be infertility as a result. That's mm-hmm. just not true. They're conflating cross-sex hormone therapy with puberty blockers because, again, once those puberty blockers are no longer administered, you have a normal puberty. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Or in the case of someone who wishes to pursue gender-affirming care mm-hmm. in the way of, like, by the way of, like, cross-sex hormone therapy, mm-hmm. then they can start that, right? Yeah. Instead of experiencing the puberty that will cause them a great deal of emotional and physical distress, mm-hmm. right? And
if which usually translates into harm as well.
Yeah, if we're talking about, like, the well-being, you know, and the quality of someone's life, mm-hmm. why wouldn't you want to give them the option? And frankly, the myth that there's no oversight given here, it is incredibly difficult to access gender-affirming care. Mm-hmm. It is not easy. You don't just walk into, mm-hmm. you know, a place in our society, in Canada, and just get
hormones. That's what the rhetoric wants you to believe, for sure.
Because they're getting the rhetoric from the United States, which has an entirely privatized healthcare mm-hmm. system, where if you get the right doctor... Yeah, you probably could.
Yeah.
And do I think that's right? Well, it's not for me to decide. I'm not a citizen of the United States. Yeah. I'm a citizen in Canada. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the law here. I've had to bring this conversation back to that with people who are trying to, like, debate this with me. And mm-hmm. just, like, you're bringing up issues that don't exist here.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the facts. You don't know anything about the Canadian healthcare system mm-hmm. if you're telling me that that's happening here, because it's not.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and you would know.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Well, you know, when I was trying to access gender-affirming care, I was not doing very well mm-hmm. mental health-wise. I was on, like, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, mm-hmm. Anti-anxiety medication, because I was just really unwell, mm-hmm. right? Having to deal with the system that you're mm-hmm. subjected to in order to access gender-affirming care. So at the time, this was before you were allowed to see a practitioner outside of CAMH.
Mm, okay.
Right? I was living in Toronto, and you had to go through the gender identity clinic at CAMH. There was no other place for you to go mm-hmm. to get a referral for gender-affirming care. Right? I was on that wait list for a year and a half. At that time, you also had to present to your psychiatrist or psychologist and your GP that you've been living in Roll. What does it mean to be living in Roll? You ask people to use your name, your pronouns, refer to you as the gender that you wish to be referred to, and without receiving any healthcare to help you with that or any support, right? And you're essentially humiliating yourself for a whole calendar year at your job, at your school, and in your social life, right? That's how that goes. Wow. And for anyone to go through that experience at that time, it's really tough. It's really tough. You have to deal with, people rejecting, outright rejecting you in terms of, what you want to be referred to. On the regular, and even after you start receiving, at least some support for that, right? You still have to experience that. You still have to tolerate it until such a time as you no longer experience, and in some cases this never happens, you no longer experience misgendering, or you no longer experience people who recognize you as queer or as trans, such that they can just pick you out of a crowd and abuse you, right? For some people, that danger never ends.
Yeah.
And so understanding that these folks need support, and affirmation as early as possible to avoid the isolation that comes with a society that doesn't accept you.
Yeah.
And further to that end, the mental health resources and the healthcare resources that we have to provide to that person with our taxpayer dollars, let's not forget. If you want to bring it back to the dollars and cents, how much money are we spending on refusing people healthcare, right? How much money are we spending on refusing people access to care? And then that's not just for trans people. That's for diabetics. That's for people with MS. That's anyone who experiences a chronic condition, right? If you're not providing them timely and adequate access to care, the bill just rises and rises and rises exponentially because they're having to access tertiary resources that are also government funded, right?
Yep.
To take care of their well-being in the meantime, right?
Yeah. Unbelievable. And then we expect everyone to be okay.
Yeah.
Right? They expect everyone to be fine emotionally. Why are you so angry? Why are you hurting so much? Why are you hurting yourself?
Yeah, well, you took away the most gentle accessed reasonable lifeline that some of these folks can access, and it's mostly just being supported.
Yeah,
just being supported in some of the most I would argue in terms of material things, really superficial.
Yeah.
How many of your friends have a nickname? You know what I mean?
Thank goodness.
Yeah, how many people go by a name that maybe their middle name? Okay? Maybe they only use one of their last names instead of two, like me, because I had a hyphenated last name at birth because my parents could not decide on one.
So they went with both.
Yeah, it was something. But things like that where we're not recognizing the holistic effects. We're only looking at the rhetorical impact and the short-term political benefit of throwing a good chunk of people just under the bus, right?
Yeah, and they're not aware that what that's going to create are more generations of humans that have a hard time functioning. Right? Because of different emotional, psychological, spiritual difficulties, physical challenges, as well as abuse, right? That we'll experience, any queer person will experience, let alone the added element of trans person, right? Because now there's just so much ignorance and hate out there, specifically towards trans, right? And it's obviously it's awful, but it's not going to go anywhere until we can somehow, not we, you and me, but until humans can somehow understand that this is legitimately just a human thing. It's just how some humans are, right? It's not a, when we were talking just a minute ago about the chronic illness or whatever, chronic condition, I in no way want to compare being queer to, or trans to a chronic condition, right? Because, I know the, maybe it's more of a condition, and my brain was thinking chronic pain and chronic illness,
Right.
Because I never want people to think that I believe that, because I don't. Because it's not a an illness of any kind.
I think, like, when you're talking about, like, a chronic condition, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have to be referring to health, right?
Yeah, like, I just lots
you,
of
you could be a chronic weed smoker.
That's right. Like, that's right. And nothing wrong with that. And the chronic, even the chronic condition is like, in the recovery community, though, lots of people will look at that as like an illness, right? Yeah. They'll be like chronic illness.
Well, it's easier for people to understand that analog,
yeah,
right? And a lot of trans people have used this analog, and it's to varying degrees mm-hmm. of efficacy, and also has been used against them, right? Mm-hmm. If we're talking about like trans medicalism and people who advocate for the idea that you have to, you know, because being trans, and this is the argument, this is not what I believe at all, because you are trans and it is classified as, at one time was classified as a disorder, mm-hmm. a mental disorder.
Yeah. Hence why I wanted to make the distinction.
That's yeah, it's no longer classified as a yeah. disorder. It's classified yeah. as a condition, right? It's okay. a condition of being a person that
condition
can occur.
Of humanness, yeah.
Yeah, that can okay. occur, right?
Excellent.
It's not an illness. It's not a disease. Right. But for the longest time, that was the only way trans people could access care, mm-hmm. was being diagnosed with a disease or a disorder, mm-hmm. right? And again, like... The gentleman who developed that framework mm-hmm. Also was a creep. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
He was of the firm belief that like all trans women are narcissistic. They mm-hmm. are they want they're autogynephilic, meaning they love the idea of thinking of themselves as a woman having sex.
And that's what it's all about.
And that's what it's all about.
Gotcha.
Problem solved. You know, like,
all right.
It was
Thanks
really...
Thanks for coming in today.
Yeah. So one of the lead, like, Jeez. Researchers of trans identity, because let's not forget, the majority of research on gender identity mm. and sexual behavior in humans was destroyed in the Holocaust. Mm. It was one of the first things destroyed in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Right? Jeez. So, yeah. you know, the Nazis burned those books. Mm-hmm. They burned our entire history. And knowledge about like formal knowledge. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget that like indigenous communities around the world, and
our knowledge cultures
and their knowledge keepers and their oral histories mm-hmm. include trans people, mm-hmm. include people who are of diverse gender and sexual identity, right? And so there's that. And like humans aren't the only organisms that exhibit this. Like,
know.
You know,
yeah.
we were talking about like seahorses, birds, mm-hmm. and all number of animals that also
naturally exist,
mm-hmm. and they actually naturally take on different sex characteristics mm-hmm. based on their environment, mm-hmm. right? So,
yeah, and that makes it makes sense to me. Just it's obvious, obviously. But yeah, thank you for coming in. I don't want to take up any more of your time. It's almost been 2 hours. So. Yeah, I just really appreciate your time and your expertise, because obviously, like, I'm pretty ignorant, but I'm learning more and more as I get brought, as it gets brought to me how ignorant I am. Let's just put it that way, because I don't mind clearing that stuff up for myself, right?
Yeah, I think like the worst thing you can do is fall into the trap of thinking you know enough.
Yeah.
Right. You could never know enough.
No.
There's just so many things on this earth.
So many things to know.
Yeah, there's so yeah. many things to know. And yeah. like, and the minute you think that you know it all, or you know enough, mm-hmm. right, you close yourself off to learning things. And that's really, I think, something that everyone would benefit from incorporating mm-hmm. in their life.
Totally. So thank you so much, Bo, for coming
yeah.
on.
No, thank
and
you.
Also, I want to thank you for how you dealt with our interruption. I believe that not only did you teach me lots about the world, but like, I mean, in that one instance when you came back in and we were both, Darcy and I were both like, man, that guy who was pounding on the door was a real jerk. Like we were just like all jerk, but you were so much like, so much love came out of you when you responded, when you came back in the room. And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I want you to know it didn't go unnoticed.
Oh, you know, the guy needed me to move my car. It was perfectly
I know
fine.
It wasn't a big deal, but the yeah. way he was going about it was like, it aggravated both Darcy and I. And mm-hmm. so I appreciate the fact that you were able to just engage. And it wasn't even about us, which is the funny thing. It was more directed at you, right? In terms of just the car parked there and not being able to reach you and all that stuff. So
in some cases, it's just, you know, it's just not worth the energy. It's just not worth the energy. It's just like, you know, water off a duck's back, let it happen. And then, you know, nobody's hurt. Great.
Well, thanks for doing that anyway. Yeah. Thank you both.
Thanks.